You're listening to Pop Journalism.
Can you like to have on?
I guess I love
you. Imagine a new
you. You haven't lost your touch.
Can you like to have on?
It's hard to believe the drama is over.
I see you haven't lost your touch.
Can you like to have on?
I guess I love you.
It's hard to believe the drama is
you
over.
You haven't lost your touch.
Well, that's all the scripted stuff.
Pop Journalism.
Hi, I'm Robert Ballantyne, and welcome to another edition of Pop Journalism on CKLN 88.1 FM. It's around 7 o'clock in the morning, and we're competing against the World Cup soccer finals. So an extra thanks to those tuning in. This week we take a look at the hoopla surrounding the G8 summit in Kananaskis, Alberta. We'll also begin a series of profiles with Canadian journalists. Catherine Dunphy, a Governor General Award-nominated author, and reporter for the Toronto Star joins us. And of course, we'll have our irregular look at the news with the week in review. We'll be right back. You're listening to Pop Journalism on CKLN. Contact us by email at popjournalism@rogers.com. You can also call live during the show at area code 416-595-1655. We also have a website at popjournalism.netfirms.com.
Thank you.
It's hard to believe the drama is over.
I see you haven't lost your touch.
Good morning and welcome back. Started out really warm this morning. It's about 20 degrees right now, and it's going to be a high of 29. It's going to be a sunny, warm day. As usual in Toronto, we'll get to a few more issues about our city's condition in this week in review. Here we go. Heads of state and ministers from the eight most powerful nations in the world met this week. The group of eight faced one of the largest recent economic justice protests last year in Genoa, Italy. The G8 indirectly controls most of the world's major economic and political institutions. Access for journalists to the summit was restricted and under tight security. But Thatcher Collins for Free Speech Radio News got into the inner sanctum. He reports from Calgary.
G7 leaders arrived yesterday, one by one, at Calgary International Airport, greeted with cowboy hats and national anthems. This is German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder. The heads of state transferred to military helicopters flying to the remote mountain resort of Kananaskis. The official program focuses on an aid program for Africa, counter-terrorism policies, and economic stability. Yet when U.S. President George W. Bush officially announced on Monday the new U.S. policy promoting an interim Palestinian state without Palestinian Authority President Yasser Arafat, this upstaged the official agenda. Canadian Prime Minister Jean Chrétien disagrees with this policy.
And I hope that it will be a real election that will produce somebody that will be democratically elected. I'm not, the president talk about perhaps it would be better to replace Mr. Arafat. I don't have a specific point of view on that. I will think it might be a good thing. I don't want to comment on that. But I just say that we need quick election there and to produce the best leadership with us.
Bush answered reporters saying the latest invasion of the West Bank was justified. Oil is an unofficial part of the agenda. African countries who are set to receive aid are mostly major oil producers. The oil-dominated economy of Alberta is the perfect Canadian summit location. Here is Chrétien's opening comment to Bush.
Well, I'm delighted to have the president in Kananaskis. It's a beautiful part of Canada, and it's where we produce oil and natural gas that you guys need a lot.
That's right.
I wanted to show.
The few journalists allowed at the press photo op turned press conference were shuttled from Calgary to Kananaskis under heavy security. But only a handful of the 1,000 journalists left behind in Calgary attended non-governmental organizations and activist press conferences yesterday, including Doctors Without Borders, Representative Dr. James Orbinski.
The Global Drug Fund. That fund was created last June by Kofi Annan and again endorsed by the G8 at Genoa. And that fund calls for a $10 billion a year investment in funds toward the containment and treatment of AIDS, TB, and malaria. To date, that fund has only received only $580 million per year from the G8 countries. That represents between 5 and 7% of what the fund actually requires to function.
As Bush and Chrétien chatted, the city of Calgary held a rodeo for the press and lower-level G8 delegates. Here, I donned an official free white cowboy hat, made in Mexico, with my press badge, sponsored by Unicom, and a can of beer, brewed in Calgary. Talisman Energy is another sponsor, a Calgary-based oil company whose money Amnesty International says is fueling human rights abuses by military leaders in the Sudan.
The Calgary Stampede!
Yeah! Yeah!
And now, let the show begin!
Journalist snacked on Alberta beef and Alberta pork before watching a bull with his testicles tied charge three poker players in the ring. I listened to journalists talk about how small and insignificant today's protest will be. Quote, no way will they get critical mass in Calgary. My bus out of the Stampede security zone was delayed by a protest of 2,000 people outside.
We don't want anyone leaving right now. Especially people don't know the area. They could end up right in the mall.
Yeah, they can now move.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Thatcher Collins in Calgary.
Back in Kananaskis this week, a British journalist stumbled upon security plans for the G8 summit. Despite about $500 million of our tax dollars being spent on protecting the world's leaders, this British journalist obtained seating plans and diagrams of rooms at the resort. He found it at a picnic site outside the security perimeter. A Canadian government official declared that the document was an outdated plan, one of the many working documents that were changed over time. I guess we'll have to take their word for it. We put up with humid summers, we put up with smog. But Toronto's also been enduring the difficulties of a drawn-out strike between city workers and the municipal government. That means no garbage pickup, no recreation services, and most importantly, no garbage pickup. Already, some of the city's garbage has begun to pile up. Designated garbage transfer stations, a fancy term for city dumps, can take hours. However, the union claims all this inconvenience and the strike is only about job security.
We have been crystal clear for weeks about what the important issues of this negotiation are, and the city has refused, absolutely refused, to address any of those main concerns.
Our ever-shy mayor, Mel Lastman, had this to say in response.
I think they pissed away their summer, to be perfectly frank with you. And I can't see them coming back before September, October.
Right now, there's no summer activities for the kids, no garbage pickup for major events like today's Gay Pride Parade, and next month's visit from the Pope. Either way, it's a smelly deal for city residents. Apparently, Italian television viewers prefer commercials to entertainment programming. The statement is the result of a survey of almost 1,000 Italian TV viewers. Most of the respondents said that Italian television is less than highbrow. Commercials do a better job of creating excitement and showing engaging TV personalities. Domestic diva Martha Stewart faced more than her usual share of media scrutiny this week. Stewart was featured on the cover of Newsweek because of accusations of insider trading. It's perfect for the media. After the economic scandals of Enron and WorldCom, a celebrity like Stewart puts a famous face on corporate corruption. And who is more equally loved and hated than Stewart?
You don't want to skimp on the lemon.
But the perfect image of Stewart was up for dissemination as she made her regular appearance on CBS's The Early Show on Tuesday. In a moment worthy of parody on Saturday Night Live, Stewart tried to duck host Jane Clayson's interrogation by focusing on preparing her salad.
Good friend Martha Stewart has been in the headlines lately, fighting allegations of insider stock trading.
Hi, well, we're going to make salad.
It wasn't Stewart's best PR moment, and eventually she did have to turn away briefly from chopping cabbage to respond.
I think this will all be resolved in the very near future, and I will be exonerated. I know that any ridiculousness.
Strangely, the Stewart scandal brought out some more venom from the usually excellent reporter, Adrian Arsenal. Here are some clips from her report for CBC's The National.
Nice try, but Martha Stewart, domestic goddess, can't hide behind her cabbage this time. She, of all things perfect, a woman who built a business empire on the image of the superhuman homemaker. Not so fast. By the way, the head of the investigating committee,
Louisiana Congressman Billy Chosen,
is a Martha Stewart regular.
It's rich food, this Louisiana.
Cajun food is
delicious.
Robust,
not the gumbo,
spicy,
the story. Americans who already consider Martha mocking a sport seem to really enjoy going after her now. Adrian Arsenault, CBC News, Washington.
The irony is thicker than that congressman's Louisiana gumbo. The media odd couple of the week has to be The National's Peter Mansbridge interviewing U2's Bono.
He's known simply as Bono, short in name, long in reputation.
I think Peter knows something we don't hear.
In the world of music, no band is bigger than U2.
Of course, Bono was there for more serious issues. He spoke about Africa and AIDS.
You know, on a recent poll of evangelical churches, only 6% said they wanted to do something about AIDS. I mean, it is unbelievable. And the leprosy of our time, if you like.
At the end of the interview, a promise was made for Bono to return to CBC to talk about the same issues again next year.
Bono, it's been good of you to talk to us, and we will talk to you a year from now. Thank you.
Okay.
Bono, short in name, long in reputation.
Thanks, Peter. Bye.
If you thought Toronto's rental market was tough, you haven't lived in Hong Kong. Rental properties owned by the Hong Kong Housing Authority are seeking 3,000 people to live in their apartments. The problem is not high rent, but the fact that the apartments are believed to be haunted. Gruesome murders and suicides have taken place in some of the apartments. The apartments are also close to trash dump sites and have common bathrooms and kitchens. Property prices in Hong Kong are among the most expensive in the world. Nevertheless, about 10,000 applicants are expected to vie for the haunted suites. And finally, we have two deaths to announce in the media this week. Bass player for British rockers The Who, John Entwistle, died of an apparent heart attack in his Las Vegas hotel room on Thursday, a day before the group was scheduled to open its tour. And just last night it broke that singer Rosemary Clooney died. She was the mellow voice singer who co-starred with Bing Crosby in White Christmas. She died after 6 p.m. last night in her Beverly Hills hotel room, and she had been hospitalized earlier this month, suffering from a recurrence of lung cancer. But we'll pay tribute to The Who, it's early Sunday morning. They've actually replaced Entwistle just yesterday. They said they were going to hire a session musician for their U.S. tour starting on Monday. But here we go, My Generation.
Don't you all fade away.
Talking about my generation.
Don't try to dig what we all
talking
say.
Talking about my generation.
Not trying to cause a big sensation.
Talking about my generation.
Talking about my generation.
Talking about my generation.
My generation. My generation, dig what we all say. Cause we get around.
Things
ain't too awful.
Talking about my generation.
I hope I die before I get old.
We'll be right back.
Yeah, you can't beat the Who for a good morning wake up. And right now we're going to throw it over to an interview. The G8 summit has passed, but the media memories remain. One of our CKLN staffers, Christiana Clemens, was in Ottawa to visit the protest sites, and regular CKLN listeners will recognize Clemens, who hosts our news magazine Word of Mouth Fridays and appears on some of our PSAs from time to time. We spoke about mainstream media coverage and even touched on the recent controversy around the firing of Ottawa Citizen publisher Russell Mills by media conglomerate Canwest Global. Mills lost his job earlier this month after publishing an article critical of Prime Minister Jean Chrétien and an editorial calling for him to resign. He's suing for libel now, and the libel allegations arise out of interviews given by Canwest chief Leonard Asper, which were then broadcast and published by Global, the National Post, and the Ottawa Citizen, who are also part of his lawsuit. Mills claims Asper was dismissed by Canwest because he repeatedly failed to comply with the basic principles of journalism. Mills says he was let go because he failed to obtain Canwest's approval of the Chrétien editorial. And thousands of readers, in a show of mainstream solidarity, which is kind of strange, against a media conglomerate, canceled subscriptions to Ottawa Citizen and Canwest papers around the country. And now we're going to go to Christiana and our talk yesterday.
They have to assert themselves very strongly as the source of so-called objective information about political and economic issues, because that's what it's that having that power over public opinion that enables them to get advertising dollars to continue to employ and continue to publish, continue to broadcast. And so I think, you know, all of these things are related to the fundamental issue of having, a media which is supposed to apparently serve the public interest or represent popular opinion, but which is essentially in the back pocket of the same huge corporations, the powers of which activists have been struggling to fight and to resist for a long time.
It's sort of the main argument, isn't it, that the media is not doing their job, they're too corporate, they're too this. Is there a failure on the activist part?
Well, you know, yesterday on my news program, Word of Mouth, I played a press conference that was given by organizers of the No One is Illegal March, which was held in Ottawa on Thursday, the 27th, an anti-G8 action focusing specifically on the rights of immigrants and refugees in the aftermath of the war on terrorism, particularly in solidarity with struggles for self-determination and liberation worldwide. The analysis behind that march and its organizing was very solid, but the people that came to report on it kept on saying, do you advocate breaking windows? What do you feel about the violence or the lack of violence yesterday? Are you grateful to the police for not being more confrontational yesterday? Really redundant questions that had nothing to do with the issues that the organizers wanted to address in the press conference. But really, I think what I saw there was more clearly than I have ever seen at a press conference on an activist or protest issue, and I've been to many. But there it was just very, very clearly spelled out that these organizers had very solid political analysis that they were trying to get across. And the journalists that were there to cover it weren't interested in that analysis. All they cared about was trying to get one of them to say in a 5-second soundbite that they advocated direct action or vandalism, you know, which wasn't coming across. And so a lot of the journalists left kind of frustrated. But I think that goes to show you that, no, it's not a problem with the activists. I mean, these people work together in their communities all the time, and the outreach involved in getting thousands of people together for a march like this is involved and involves a lot of public relations, a lot of media relations. It's the mainstream media system that refuses to acknowledge that organizing and that analysis, and that's, in my view, solely where the problem lies.
Well, the argument is on the media side that you know, they sort of say they're hooligans, they're a bunch of, you know, the typical arguments. And
but why are they saying that when it's so obvious that these people are not hooligans, that they are committed political activists? Jaggi Singh, for example, was saying yesterday, you know, the same people that engage in a protest march, the same people that are chalk drawing on the streets, are the same people that work at food banks for, you know, in groups lobbying for genetically modified free food, in groups lobbying for nuclear disarmament, for the peace movement, and groups working in their communities in anti-poverty issues, on advocacy, on immigrant and refugee rights, in anti-racist work. I mean, these are the same people struggling every day to try and make a better world for the people around them, not necessarily for the dollar value of what its reward is, but in order to try and ensure that, that people can have safer, you know, more community-oriented, more just existences in this world, all of the actions, and there were many, not just two marches in Ottawa at least, and there were many, you know, happening all across the country in opposition to the G8. Because these actions were peaceful, it really pulls the rug under that whole notion of radicals being hooligans who don't understand what they want or what they're fighting against. It's been a very directed campaign on the part of the media to portray activists as not having analysis and to pick out less experienced activists, you know, to use for sound bites. And it doesn't matter, you know, how many hours of footage they've recorded of really articulate people, they will still, you know, seize on the sound bite of the person who seems to not really be able to back up their opinions with solid evidence. For an issue that dealing with, you know, the stock market or corporate buyouts, they'll get very, you know, very knowledgeable analysts and people from the right to go and expound on those issues. I think what it reflects most clearly is just the bias of the media.
Do you think maybe the activists should do some PR with the media?
Oh, I do agree that they've been represented in an extremely negative light by the media. But I also think, and you know, many activists and many activist groups, especially the, you know, larger, more well-organized groups, Council of Canadians, also groups like Amnesty International, Greenpeace, Oxfam, all of those groups have extremely sophisticated PR and media relations people working there and extremely articulate PR and media relations campaigns happening. But by and large, no matter what kind of PR and media relations ammunition you have, when the very system that you're trying to engage is completely opposed or completely blind to your point of view and the work that you're trying to do, it makes it a little bit difficult. I think certainly, you know, in the alternative press, these issues get treated in a fair light. This is the whole reason why we have independent media centers. As a way for journalists who are not part of that mainstream corporate system to get together and to publish and to, you know, share in their information with a wide audience without having to deal with the obvious editorial constraints of the corporate media system. You know, having your own publishing venue enables you to create an analysis which doesn't have to be compressed into a 5-second soundbite. You know, you can expand on the issues a little more clearly. And I think that's the whole reason why the Indie Media Network in particular has expanded so rapidly and become so huge and engaged so many activists and journalists to become a part of that, because it is one of the most coherent coalitions of alternative and independent journalists. It gives them sort of a center to work from. You need something like that if you're going to try to present an analysis different from what you see on mainstream television and in the newspapers.
So what do you see as the future? What is going to happen, and the media is going to say, oh, there's going to be lots of violence, and then it doesn't happen, and they're going, oh, well, there was no violence, and it's going to keep going in perpetuum.
Activists are going to continue to organize demonstrations against unjust and oppressive and unfair policies. Like, we're not going to see an end to the protest movement, which is something I also noticed mainstream media trying to portray in their coverage of these protests. Oh, well, since there's no more violence, there's no more protest movement. It was somehow, because these activists aren't being beat up by police anymore, well, I guess that means that they don't have very strong political views or passions somehow. I mean, which is an utterly ridiculous argument. People are going to continue to organize and continue to, you know, express themselves in the face of this oppressive system. And I think the mainstream media, as it stands right now, is going to continue to ignore a lot of those concerns, a lot of those issues. And as the future, I see, you know, people having to work extremely hard to try and educate people in a large scale, to try and develop alternatives to the mainstream media system, which, in my view, reflects nothing in terms of public interest or information access except for corporate greed.
The Russell Mills situation was really amazing in the fact that people were actually going, oh, they were outraged by it, because CanWest thing has been going on for months and months back, and now we're seeing canceled subscriptions, and we're seeing a real mainstream rally against the fact that people are being censored. And I guess independent media rises and and it all gets mixed up somehow.
We can hope so. I think, you know, what we've seen recently in the Canadian media scene is an extreme level of concentration and the shunting out of alternative points of view and dissent in all of its many forms. And as that process develops and becomes more extreme, as the Russell Mills case is one example, yes, people are going to start to wake up and say, what are my choices? Where are the alternatives? Where can I go for other sources of information? And hopefully that will give a bit of a boost to people that have been, you know, working extremely hard in alternative and independent media projects for a long, long time, and who are also, you know, an inherent part of an activist movement struggling for democracy, freedom, justice, freedom of expression, and freedom for individuals to assert themselves in the public sphere. My experience in Ottawa really opened my eyes. I mean, I've been working on issues of media democracy and been part of the independent media for quite a while, but my experience in Ottawa really was still just a bit of a shocker, just to see how closed-minded and with blinders on the mainstream journalists could be in their reaction to these activists and to the protests. As that gets more extreme, yes, windows of opportunity will open for those of us who you know, want to foster healthy debate in the public sphere and get other points of view out there. So hopefully, you know, things are going to progress.
And you can always check out the Indie Media website that we were mentioning in the discussion at www.indiemedia.org. And you can listen to Christiana's show, Word of Mouth, on Fridays, 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. We'll be right back. I want to try that pill that people take. Make you believe all the things that people say. Take a shot.
It's hard to believe the drama is over.
Tragedy struck. I see you haven't lost your touch.
Too often when we watch television, we are mystified by the images on the screen. So much so that we tend to miss the effects sound alone has on us. Take the impact of radio, for example. So we here at Pop Journalism wondered, what does television sound like without images? The results are strange, funny, and sometimes just plain creepy. This is an unedited recording of a random day of remote-controlled fun. We call it channel surfing.
$15 billion in debt relief, and to commit at least half their annual aid budgets to the struggling continent. Aid that will be linked directly to African governments.
Must be legal drinking age.
Full of people.
Yeah, not now.
Then there's the Centerville Amusement Park.
A new big screen TV.
Free golf club in Ajax today.
And gain a whole new life. That was then, and this is this now.
With the largest selection of pools, spas, and
panniers,
and schools became commonplace after Pearl Harbor was...
But others take issue.
...touring and detecting drug use.
...part of the province of Alberta. Meanwhile, good news in Arizona...
$100 million right away.
Easy. So if somebody, it was an XL, they could try... Oh, definitely. No question about that.
See a slight chance of a shower or thunderstorm, but very slight and in for great weather.
Oh, no. Now, I can also make baby food, and I think that this is very important. You can make the freshest, healthiest baby food without additives, without preservatives. It's the best way to feed your children. And, not, you know, the baby food, all of these kinds of things. Now, this is carrots, but it could be green beans. It could be spinach. It could be peas. It could
That's
be virtually
great.
Anything.
I want to taste that, too. I mean, fresh baby food.
Fresh,
I mean, fresh carrots.
With no preservatives, no chemicals, no additives.
Now, how about Lionel Hampton on drums?
I don't know what, I think that's a dolphin or something. Welcome back to Pop Journalism, I'm Robert Ballantyne. It's halftime for World Cup, by the way. Usually as the exciting game of soccer goes, it's 0-0. Ooh, so you're not missing much if you're hanging in there. Appreciate it, by the way. And right now, we tend to speak of the media as this mass anonymous force. But behind the media are individual reporters, people with families, mortgages, and puppies. Well, you know what I'm saying. Every day, these reporters face near impossible deadlines and are privy to the best and worst of our society. So we pull back the curtain behind the people behind the news we read. I spoke with Toronto Star reporter Catherine Dunphy, who also wrote a critically acclaimed book about abortionist Henry Morgenthaler.
Is it right if I call you Kathy on the air?
Of course.
Okay. You've held a lot of different reporting beats at the Toronto Star. Could you maybe run down some of the more interesting beats you've had over the years?
that makes it hard. The one that people always like to hear about the most is 2 years as a movie reviewer, because I suppose it's everyone's dream job that they think they get to see movies free and without people crunching popcorn in your ear and crinkling candy wrappers. And you get to see it before anybody else. And you, ostensibly, you have the privilege or pleasure of interviewing all the stars. And what I found was after 2 years of this, I thought I was going to go mad. I felt as if I might as well just walk in to a hotel room, put the tape recorder down, sort of salute whatever the star was and walk out, and they could just talk, and then I come back, pick it up, and write the story. That's how personal it was. And people were always saying, oh, did you meet Kevin Costner? And I never knew what to say. Yes, we were in the same room. Meet? Don't think so. And it was so programmed that I just went nuts. And after a while, you know, the majority of movies are not stinkers, and they're not wonderful. They just exist. And it's really hard. There's only so many words in the English language. And the other thing I found, too, was that I have certainly had an interest in anything Canadian, and I was really getting tired of using the word quirky, because everything Canadian seemed to be quirky. And that's the beat that most people talk about. But I suppose the one that I found I went through a lot of personal growth in was covering the homeless for 3 or 4 years just recently. And then there were some other individual specific assignments as a feature writer. And that is the summation of the highlights of my career.
When did you start as a journalist?
Oh, my God, I knew you were going to ask that. I'm trying to think now. I really am, because I've had a bit of a checkered career, to put it mildly. I think my first job at a newspaper was in the mid-70s. Yeah, so it's been off and on, and the offs are when I was fired, and the ons are when I wasn't, since then.
Okay, let's back up there. You were fired.
Of course. I want that known, because I remember when I was fired from my first job, which was at a radio station, and I was devastated until somebody older and wiser took me aside and started naming all kinds of names of fabulous writers and journalists whom I simply revered, and basically pointed out where they've been fired from. But I think this profession is still one of egos and volatility and lots of heads roll for no discernible reason. No big deal to be fired. And I think that's a message for everybody nowadays and getting in the business. Don't worry. It's okay.
Did you face any extra challenges? It's sort of post-feminist, but did you have any extra challenges because you started in the mid-70s being a woman?
I think so. You know, it wasn't post-feminist. It's interesting you should say that. I think probably the last 5 years probably is post-feminism, but certainly, well, maybe 10, but certainly this has always been seen as a man's game. And because I really enjoy writing, the craft of writing, and I like people's stories, and I think that's perceived as soft. And then you end up in this ghetto of, you know, lifestyle and this sort of thing, which I think is a shame it's a ghetto, because I think it's where a lot of the issues were first reported. And they only become respectable or worthy of the front page when the issues finally, you know, creep their way up into, you know, parliament or a bill or something like that. But I think they're far more interesting from a journalistic point of view when they're at the grassroots level or when they're at their agitating level or when that sort of thing. So in that regard, yeah, feminism was tough. But at one point, I think it was the 80s, early 80s, there was a women's caucus at the Toronto Star where I was, and I belonged to it. And we really worked hard because there were no women critics in entertainment. There were no women in the sport. There were no women in upper management. I think Rosie DiMano had just started her column, just. There wasn't a lot, and we did need that. We did need to sort of agitate a bit. And to his credit, John Hondrick,
He's the publisher of the Star, right?
Yeah, but at that point, I think he was editor. He was very open-minded about the whole thing and certainly listened to the concerns and made some decisions to try and get women in more positions of perceived influence, feel more the opinion makers and this kind of thing. So, yeah, post-feminism, I wish, but I don't think.
You're also an author. People might find that odd that journalists jump into authorship interchangeably nowadays.
I don't know what people think of journalists anymore. I think you should do a show on that and have people phone or write in and tell you what they think, because I'd love to know for one. But, yeah, there's a number of many, many journalists write books, and they're not all nonfiction. I think journalism is a wonderful basis for any form of writing, because it simply teaches you how to listen. You have to listen, and if you listen, then you can get people's cadences if you're writing fiction and dialogue, for instance. It also teaches you how to structure and how to understand and get right into essence, and that you need for any book you write, whether it's a biography, as I wrote, or you know, a polemic, or long fiction, or a novel, or whatever. So journalism brings you up front and fairly close to wonderful cast characters, which can only add to the type of depth and whatnot that you want in your own writing. So I'm a firm believer that this is journalism is a basis of a lot of cross-pollination. But I recognize that maybe a lot of people would be surprised to find the number of journalists who are writing books and going back and forth. And the reason they go back and forth is, of course, there's no money in writing books. But for a journalist, there's a great deal of satisfaction in doing it, because you finally have a chance to sit down and you have the luxury of length and you can really describe something. And it's fun, and I think that's why we do it so often.
I was fascinated when you told me this story about how you got the offer to do the book on Morgan Taller. You were actually asked to do it.
I was asked to do it. And I sometimes think it's because no one else wanted to do it. and then I went and approached Henry Morgenthaler himself, because I obviously needed to interview him. And the editor of the time, Doug Pepper, thought that Henry, and rightfully so, thought that Henry would be a fabulous subject of a book. I mean, here's a man who's been hogging the headlines in this really, really difficult and contentious issue for 20 years, and really he's one of the most known people, I mean, in terms of recognizable faces in the country, and yet a bit of a cipher. No one knows him. No one knows who he was and is. They did come and ask me to do it, and I thought my ship had come in. I was so excited. So I went off. Henry and I had lunch, and I thought I was going to have to convince him totally that I would have to do a sales pitch on him. And he wasn't quite sure. He thought he might do his own book. But, you know, when they say that, you always know that they won't, because then people have no idea how much work it is. So, and if they start to write after about a chapter or two, it gets really hard slogging and most of them give up. I thought, well, maybe Henry will write his own book. But then he ended up inviting me back to his office, where I ended up witnessing him do an abortion, which I thought I better do it, you know, trial by fire. And so I did, thinking I can't say, well, I'm busy, I have to race back to work, which actually I did have to race back to work. But I thought it was really important that I watch Henry at work. And it wasn't at all a trial by fire, because Henry he doesn't think of this as anything that might be unsettling or uncomfortable for people. He just thinks that this is something he does and does very well, which he does do very, very well, and this is where the man's at his best. He's warm and compassionate, and most of the women are very happy to have him do what he's doing, etc. So he was just showing off, and I was thinking that I was being tested. And we ended up forging some sort of uneasy alliance, and the book, you know, got done ultimately.
So we've covered all the basic journalism tenets: death, death, dying, abortions, and
abortion, yeah, okay.
Yeah, writing books and
movies.
Yeah, death in Hollywood, right?
Yeah.
So what was Kevin Costner like?
He's tall, unlike most other stars.
There's got to be one, though. I mean, come on. I mean, I'm starting to get into this celebrity interview thing with this show.
Yeah.
There's got to be one person who you just went, oh, this is so cool to be around this person.
I wrote up Emma Thompson when she was simply an appendage to, what was her husband then, Kenneth Branagh. And they were in town promoting some stupid movie they'd made, some sort of film noir called Dead Again, I think. And she was so brilliant. And I remember going back to the office and saying, forget him, I want to do her. And so I ended up writing about her. Well, I was right, wasn't I? And then Robin Williams was brilliant. I mean, he just is a genius. And I was just sort of blown away. I was blown away by him.
I'd be scared by him. He's all over the place.
Well, you know, he can't give a straight answer. His mind races somewhere towards the left, and he just follows it. And he's so happy if you're running to keep up with him. He's so grateful for you to do that. I think he'd love it if you were to interview him. So you should try.
Okay.
New on CKLN, a show dedicated to exploring our media and pop culture. Hi, I'm Robert Ballantyne, host of Pop Journalism, a mix of music and spoken word, Sundays from 7 to 8 a.m. That's right, Sundays 7 to 8 a.m. And if you can catch the show live, you can always visit the website at popjournalism.netfirms.com. Yes, and there is more interview with Kathy. I had to edit it for time because we are out of time, actually, this week. Kathy's taken a sabbatical out of the Toronto Star to take a break to write a new book. And she's not quite sure what she's going to do, but you know, we wish her the best of luck. Coming up after this show, of course, is The International Connection. And I am going to leave you, as I usually do, with a media soundbite. Just something random out of the universe that has no significance and is just funny in its own sort of obviousness. And so we'll see you next week. And next week's show is going to be a different kind of show. It's going to be a show about doing the show, if that makes any sense. And we'll see you next week. Remember, you can visit the website. I'll post the full Kathy interview, who was with the Toronto Star we just heard, at popjournalism.netfirms.com. I'd like to thank my guests, Christiana Clemens and Catherine Dunphy.
I'm in love with a TV star. She drove me home in her Lexus car. Like a dog, but I don't watch a show. Spend my time with the radio. Seen her dancing on the Sunset Strip. Bell-bottom jeans and her curvy hips. Seen her sitting there with her boyfriend. Good-looking fella, but he's looking kind of thin. Christina. So, remember that day we played pool? I saw your bedroom and we ate barbecue. Bobby came from a trip downtown, 50 up and 40 down. Love you more than the sun in the sky. Gotta kiss and hug you before I die. Something else that you ought to know too. Christina. La 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 Christina. La 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 Christina. La 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 la.
dog, but I don't watch the show. Spend my time with the radio. Been watching TV as the years go by. Seen them born and I seen them die. Something else that you ought to know too. I like a girl named Ellen more than you. Christina.
I had this idea for a show. Different women. Different points of view. Maybe a little too different. You know what you look like? You look like a real bitch.
I look like a real bitch.
And that's
well,
a compliment.
She's so excited.
Yeah. I can remember when this show started. When A, we weren't allowed to say the word, and B, if any of you people said it, I would say, oh, how terrible! Well, now, folks, according to this new book, if we wanted to, we could have a date every night in the week. Yeah? Because this book is called Why Men Love Bitches. From Doormat to Dream Girl, A Woman's Guide to Holding Her Own in a Relationship. It doesn't come out until the fall, but that doesn't stop us from talking about it. So, do you own up to the title?
Yes. You have to be, it means you have to be tough with them, man. Otherwise, how are they going to believe us when we fake orgasms? You have to be strong.
But why does that mean you have to be a bitch?
Seriously, there's a difference between a bitch and a real bitch.
Right.
There's another word for that.
But see, a regular, a bitch, the way I like to define it, right, a babe in total control of herself.
Yeah.
Really?
Okay. So that makes complete sense to me. That a guy would like that.
But I have a feeling they're not
in control of herself.
I have a feeling that's not the kind of bitch they're talking about in this book.
But they're talking about a strong woman, someone who's, you know, who knows control. What she's doing.
Well, not just. No, they're saying, you know, you got to play tough. You never let the guy really know that he's got you. But if you're too bitchy, then he says, what do I need this for? I'm going to marry that nice...
bitch down the block.
But you're not allowed to be nasty.
That bitch who's not acting like a bitch.
Men who like bitches or love bitches are bitches as far as I'm concerned. I really believe. I don't know. The one man in the audience is applauding.
They're talking a real bitch, a really nasty bitch. We're not talking about that. That's like a woman who always...
Okay, let me read
who always like, let me finish this definition,
okay.
I think. This is a real bitch now.
Okay.
Somebody who always lets a man pay for dinner, even if she has an expense account. That is a real bitch. We're
sense.
Not talking about that.